Welcome to Look Ahead Radio and Viewpoints Around the World. My name is Tom Arms, and in a moment I'll be joined by my old friend Lockwood Phillips. This week we have a lot to talk about. There's the fallout from Michael Wolff's book on the Trump administration, German coalition talks, more news on Brexit and Catalonia and North Korea. I hope you enjoy the discussion. Thanks very much for listening.
Welcome to Look Ahead Radio with Tom Arms and Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints on the Talk Station, FM 107 AM 1240. And it's that time of the evening when we're doing Viewpoints Around the World with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. Just to remind you, if you wish, you want to get tomorrow's news today, log on to lookaheadnews.com and become a subscriber. Just a little note at the beginning of the program, I'm looking forward to today's conversation with Tom Arms, joining us from the United Kingdom, London, as a matter of fact. And yes, this portion of the program has been pre-recorded to account for the late hour of which this will be airing. It'll be almost, midnight for him there in London. And with that, Tom, good evening to you. And first, how's the weather? We've been enjoying some cold weather here. What about you?
Ah, it's almost spring-like here. Well, not spring-like, but it's unseasonably warm, I would say. Very nice. It's very nice weather. Gray skies, of course, as we often get in the winter here in London. But not too cold at all.
Well, we've had some very shocking cold here on the East Coast, particularly. Before I get into other issues, I'm just curious, has the weather situation in the United States been of interest to anyone there in the UK or probably in Europe?
Oh, yes, very much of interest. My daughter is living at the moment in New York, and she's complaining bitterly about the weather. She said she went outside to the shop and came back and was having difficulty with the keys to her apartment and was right. Concerned she was going to die of hypothermia before she could get inside.
It has been very bitter cold. Yes, as a matter of fact, record cold temperatures. But I'm wondering,
It has been in other parts of Europe, too. In fact, they've had snow in the Sahara Desert.
Right. Well, have they, by the way, had a situation where you've been covering this, by the way?
What, the situation in the U.S.
in the U.S.
situation,
yeah.
In Europe?
Well, both. I mean, has weather been a topic of
oh, yes,
coverage?
Yes, it's, okay. It's been a big topic. Snow in Sahara, they've had people who are snowed into ski resorts in France and mm-hmm. Austria and Switzerland, and they've had snow in the north of England and Scotland. But here in the south of England, it's been unseasonably warm almost.
Ah, all that hot air. We won't describe where it's from, whence it's issuing.
Not coming from me.
All right. Speaking of hot air, I'm curious about the coverage of the Wolff book, Fire and Fury. And this, of course, related to President Trump. How has that gotten a great deal of coverage there?
Day after day, lots and lots of coverage. The reaction, I think, was summed up in a Times editorial, which said the most surprising thing about the Wolff book mm-hmm. is that no one is surprised.
Are they accepting the Wolff book as being accurate?
Yes.
Really?
At the same time, they're accepting it as being largely accurate.
Oh.
You know, there is some fact checking going along. I mean, certainly, you know, they accept all the Steve Bannon quotes as accurate because he hasn't really denied them, except to try and shift the sort of emphasis of what he said about treason, saying it really didn't involve Trump Jr., which I think if you read it carefully, that doesn't make sense. He was really talking about the people who were at the meeting.
Right.
And he's just trying to save his own skin, which he's failed to do.
Right.
Now, the latest thing that's come out being reported by the BBC, I don't know how much credence it's being given there in the U.S., is the BBC is sort of drawing attention to the fact that the White House phoned they're reporting that the White House phoned, mm-hmm. I should make that clear, Breitbart investors and told them to put pressure on Breitbart to get rid of Bannon. Now, to my mind, that is serious breach of freedom of speech and press on the part of the White House. I should also, you know, stress, and this was stressed by a few people here, that when they tried to stop publication of the book, that also is a breach of freedom of press and freedom of speech. And it's a clear one, and it was decided by the Supreme Court as early as 1931.
Keep in mind, the issue here, of course, was accuracy and also the topic of slander. And
yes, the Supreme Court is very clear on that. And it says, if there's an issue of accuracy, then they can sue after publication.
Well,
if it's libelous, they can sue after publication. But, and they made it absolutely clear in 1931, to try and prevent publication is censorship.
Well, you are then laying claim to the fact that the president probably was attempting to stop publication. I find that.
Well, he made it clear that he was.
Well, it's
he
also.
He said he was.
Well, he was.
Or his lawyer.
But his
so
lawyer.
People representing him tried to stop publication.
Right. Well, all right. So I want to get back to the topic here for a moment that surprises me that this book is being perceived as being accurate and a true case of information. And yet we've seen a variety of stories here, even from such notable mainstream publications of the New York Times and Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, who have also raised questions as to the accuracy. Has that not made any coverage at all in the European press?
Oh, yes. Yes, okay. It has.
Okay.
Certainly it has. But as I said, they accept it as largely accurate, that it fits a pattern. You know, if you look at his tweets, if you look at the language that Trump uses, if you look at the policies, it all seems to fit into a pattern which makes sense.
All right.
And that, in fact, those were the words used by The Guardian, that, you know, that this, you know, that it is perceived as largely accurate because it fits into a known pattern.
Okay. The other aspect of this, and I'm curious, you know, there have been numerous books that have been announced, and I want to touch on another topic very quickly with you, Tom, related to entertainment in a moment. But first, there are a variety of books that are going to be released here soon. Question for you there in the European community in the United Kingdom. Are books used as much in those countries to develop and promote political agenda and support as they are in the United States? Everyone has a book in the wings here, apparently, in the States, and particularly when it comes to politics. What about there in the United Kingdom?
There are a few books. There was one called The Brexit Club, which came out after the vote on Brexit, which had quite an impact. I don't think it's quite as much as in the U.S. You will get people writing a sort of history of a government.
Right.
Of course, you get the memoirs coming out by prime ministers and foreign secretaries, things like that. And they're all anxiously awaited, and they earn a lot of money from them, and everybody buys them. But I don't think it's quite to the same degree as you have in the States.
Okay, I wondered about that. Other quick question for you, and it's we'll move on to other items here in a moment. We had the Golden Globes in the United States this past week, of course, recognizing TV and movies, and the issue of harassment became a topic of discussion. As a matter of fact, it seemed to be the topic for the Golden Globes as opposed to the actual honorees and recognizing artistic talent. How much coverage did that event receive there in the United Kingdom, in the European press?
It did get a lot of coverage, and the fact that a large majority of the women attending wore black, much to the chagrin of my daughter, who is currently the executive producer for videos for Vogue magazine, because it just didn't look so good to have everyone dressed in black.
Black, right.
And
So it is getting coverage. I mean, the whole issue of...
It is getting coverage. What's also getting coverage this week, I don't know if it got much coverage in the States, was a letter in Le Monde signed by 100 prominent French women.
One of them being Catherine Deneuve.
The sexual harassment story is getting out of hand.
Right.
And becoming rather puritanical, or promoting puritanicalism. They were led by the French actress Catherine Deneuve.
Right. I did read that, and I'm curious, has that received much of a reaction there in the European press? In line to the fact that this whole topic seems to be a kind of, you use the term puritanical, but a little over the top. I've even expressed that. What's the feeling there before we go to the break?
Well, I think, you know, the 100 French women have certainly put forward the other case from a feminine point of view, and it's rekindled the debate from the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And it has gotten as much press here in the UK and elsewhere in Europe, I don't know about the US, as has the Golden Globe Award, the black dresses at the Golden Globes.
Wow. All right. That's an interesting observation. Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio with us this afternoon. Tom, we'll take a quick break. Right after that, we'll come back and we'll talk about other issues, political issues. We're going to focus on Germany. You're listening to Viewpoints Around the World with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio.
Look Ahead Radio will return in just a moment.
This is Tom Arms with LookAheadNews.com's expanded world analysis for the week being the 15th of January. LookAhead broadcasts tomorrow's news today so that you can plan to participate. Next Saturday is the first anniversary of the inauguration of Donald Trump as President of the United States. Expect a flurry of tweets and editorials. But don't expect anything from Vice President Mike Pence. He will mark the occasion by flying off to the Middle East to visit Israel, Egypt, and Jordan. In the Arab countries, he will face a frosty reception following the administration's decision to move its embassy to Jerusalem. Earlier in the week, on Tuesday, President Trump meets at the White House with the President of Kazakhstan. Terrorism, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and economic cooperation are the talking points. In Europe, there will be an extraordinary meeting of Germany's Social Democratic Party on Sunday to decide whether or not to enter into formal coalition talks with Angela Merkel's CDU. The main sticking point appears how fast and far Europe moves towards political and military integration. The SPD is demanding more speed. French President Emmanuel Macron has a busy Brexit week. On Tuesday, he visits Calais, which is heavily dependent on the UK. Then on Thursday, he travels to Britain's Sandhurst Military Academy for talks with British Prime Minister Theresa May. The French defense minister meets on Monday with his counterparts from Burkina Faso, Chad, Mali, Mauritania, and Niger about increased military coordination to combat Islamic jihadists. NATO defense ministers will also discuss terrorism when they meet in Brussels on Tuesday for their regular twice-a-year session. Also on the agenda will be refugees, Syria, Ukraine, Georgia, and military training in Iraq. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov holds a press conference on Monday to summarize Russian foreign policy objectives. North Korea will be the only topic of discussion at a Vancouver conference of the foreign ministers from countries that contributed to the UN forces that fought in the 1950-53 Korean War. Catalonia's newly elected National Assembly is expected to reconvene on Wednesday for its first session since a pro-independence government was elected in a Madrid-organized poll. Former Trump advisors Paul Manafort and Richard Gates make another court appearance on Tuesday. The head of Volkswagen in Detroit, Oliver Schmidt, goes on trial on charges related to the VW diesel emissions scandal. And a former Vietnamese Politburo member faces a long prison sentence for allegedly embezzling hundreds of millions of dollars. On Wednesday, an American exploration company resumes the search for missing Malaysian airliner Flight 370. If they find it, they will secure a $70 million reward. And that was next week's news today from LookAheadNews.com so that you can plan to participate in the world around you. Stay tuned for Viewpoints Around the World with myself and Lockwood Phillips.
Welcome back to Look Ahead Radio. Here is Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints Around the World with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. And yes, this portion of the program has been pre-recorded to accommodate Tom's sleeping schedule. It's nearly midnight as this program airs here on the talk station. But as always, Tom, thank you for making time for us this afternoon. Evening for you there as we begin this recording. But Tom, let's talk about the issue of Germany and Chancellor Angela Merkel and what's happening there in light of the conversations we've been having now for quite some time, better part of a year. I've challenged the potential political future of Chancellor Merkel, and it seems that there is now some real threat for her. And what part, and this is a multi-part question, not only the political aspect of this, but the economic aspect. And I want to go to the cultural aspect. How much of this is a result of Germany's efforts to accommodate the asylum seekers and the refugees? So what's happening in Germany?
Okay, well, they're having coalition talks again. They've been without a government since September. They've had a sort of caretaker government headed by Angela Merkel. But the coalition talks are between the Social Democratic Party and the CDU-CSU of Angela Merkel. Now, the Social Democrats were in coalition with Angela Merkel previously, but they suffered by being tainted with Angela Merkel. Mm-hmm. They are, you know, reasonably center-left, and Angela Merkel is center-right. What's really at stake here is not so much immigration. That's not such the big issue. It's the EU.
Right.
And Martin Schulz said back in December that if he's going to go into coalition, and he's the leader of the SPD, if he's going to go into coalition with Angela Merkel again, the price will be that they must agree to an EU constitution by the year 2025, which will create a United States of Europe in which the EU will have control over foreign, defense, and fiscal policies, and most tax policies.
Wow. Now,
of all EU countries.
Okay,
and if any countries don't want to sign up to this, they can, excuse my language, bloody well leave.
All right, here's a question for you, Tom. What is the deadline for this this constitution?
Well, according to Schulz, it's 2025.
Okay, that's
now
only...
he's leader of the Social Democratic Party. He's in talks with Angela Merkel. Angela Merkel has dismissed this.
Okay, let me interrupt.
No, I can't agree to this.
All right, let me interrupt here. Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com, LookAhead Radio. The very thing that we have talked about in the past, and that is a united Europe, if you will, a United States of Europe, things of that nature. Let's talk here for a moment on how this influences and impacts the future of the European Union with such countries. And I've got to start with your own country, well, your adopted country, the United Kingdom. What impact does this have on the efforts of pro-European Union supporters in the United Kingdom? And what impact does this have on Theresa May, Prime Minister?
Well, it would certainly help the Brexit camp. There's no doubt about that.
All right.
The British have always been a break on the issue or the dream of a United States of Europe. They want to cooperate. They want to have cooperation on foreign policy. They want to have cooperation on defense policy, but they don't want formal structures.
Okay.
And that is basically the position of Angela Merkel as well.
But the difference is we have had, if you will, kind of a quasi-united Europe because you've got the European Court, which we've talked about in the past. Question, this announcement, does this in some way not only strengthen those who have in the United Kingdom who've wanted to leave the European Union, does this also throw a wrench, if you will, into the efforts of those who want to remain?
Not yet.
But
because it hasn't really hit home here in the UK.
Wow.
It's a big issue in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what we don't know is what's going to come out of the coalition talks. I mean, this is what Martin Schulz says. But, you know, he's agreed to enter into negotiations without preconditions. but at the same time said, this is what he wants. So, you know, we don't know what will be the outcome of these talks. If they fail to agree to a coalition, then we will have elections again in Germany.
All right. Now, this then brings up a question about Jean-Claude Juncker. What exactly does this have to do with him?
Well, Jean-Claude Juncker is very much an integrationist. Mm-hmm. He is very keen on a United States of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
He was a former prime minister, finance minister and prime minister of Luxembourg.
Right.
Very well known. He became president of the council in 2014.
14, the European
He's such
Commission.
An integrationist. The only two countries that voted against his presidency were Britain and Poland, who are, if you like, slow speed integrationist at very best. He recently said, stood up and said, look, you've got to face it. You know, those people who think that Britain is going to somehow or another stay in the EU, it's not going to happen.
Okay.
Brexit will occur, he says. Now, he's never really been in favor of British membership, to be quite honest. I think he would like to see Britain leave because, as I said before, Britain has always been a brake on integration.
But Britain is a major part of the European economy. And I know that it's been a challenge for European community as well as for the United Kingdom, because we've talked about this decline of you've got businesses that are leaving Europe. I'm wondering how many of those businesses and industries are enthusiastic about a United States of Europe. Is there because there's still, if you will, some residual nationalism throughout Europe. How is this being what's the future?
I think
Tom?
Most businesses are in favor of it because, you know, there are economically it makes sense. It's the political structures where you get problems. But you're talking about Britain being part of it economically. Jean-Claude Juncker, when he made this statement about, you know, Brexit is going to happen and you better plan accordingly, was talking in the context of the fact they are going to lose, that is the EU, is going to lose about $16 billion a year, which comes from the UK in contributions to the budget. Britain is the third largest contributor to, or net contributor to EU funds.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've got to take that into account. They've got to start planning now.
All right, and you said,
how are they going to make up for this drop in income?
And this is
they've got to start thinking about how they're going to do that.
All right, we're going to come back to that in a moment, Tom, because I want to talk very briefly about the progress of this quote Brexit. Our guest, of course, our program this afternoon, not our guest, our European editor, Tom Arms, with us from LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio here on Viewpoints Around the World.
Look Ahead Radio will return in just a moment. We now return to Look Ahead Radio. Here is Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints Around the World with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. Just to remind you, two things. One, this portion has been pre-recorded to accommodate the late hour in which it will be airing. It'll be almost midnight as it's airing here on the talk station, midnight there in the United Kingdom. And of course, another item to mention to you, feel free to log on to LookAheadNews.com, become a subscriber, and get tomorrow's news today. Tom, we were just chatting a few moments ago about the proposal that European community established the, for want of a better description, the United Community or the United States of Europe with a new European Union. And I'm questioning here, you said 2027 was the date?
2025.
I'm sorry.
Was what Martin Schulz said. I'm not saying he's the only one who's put this deadline.
Okay, no. So I think it's a question, of course, of is that even reasonable deadline? But that's not to be debated here. The real question I have for you is looking at the other countries, France, for example, And we're going to get back to the to the United Kingdom here in a moment. But France, what is their sense on this? You mentioned Poland.
Emmanuel Macron would probably have positive thoughts towards that. I don't know about the details, but he's very much an integrationist as well. And I think the same would be said of Belgium, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, Italy, those countries, possibly Spain as well. Where you would find opposition is in Eastern Europe. And they are very much opposed to that sort of integration. And in fact, that's where you find the most Eurosceptic governments at the moment.
All right, we're going to get to that in a moment. I want to stay with Western Europe for a moment. Spain, you think, would be inclined to do this. I am surprised that France, in light of the fact that Emmanuel Macron has taken sort of a position of leadership within the European Union, find this interesting. The question then goes to the military. How would this be handled relative to military investment, and how would the various countries, again, going back to the nationalist pride that exists in Western Europe, how would this be handled militarily?
Well, that is a matter of discussion at the moment. And they're trying to, they are having very active talks on what sort of structure can be set up to create a European military arm. There's this expression which is used to describe the EU as an economic giant, a political dwarf, and a defense or military minnow.
Wow.
And they realize, the EU realizes, that if it's going to be a political giant, it has to have a military to back it up.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's talk about the other aspects of this, and just back to the United Kingdom for just a quick moment. You mentioned Spain would be possibly interested in this. Ireland, and this talk about this and the relationship for the efforts of the divorce proceedings, if you will. How are they coming there with Theresa May and Parliament and all the challenges and complexities of this separation?
Well, there hasn't been much change since the agreement just before December, which wasn't really an agreement. It was just a sort of papering over the cracks.
Right.
And all they agreed in December was that there would not be a hard border between North and South Ireland. But they didn't explain how that would be achieved, because while also saying that there wouldn't be a hard border, they also said that the Brexit terms under the final agreement, Britain would not be part of the single market or the customs union. And it's very difficult for you not to have a hard border, and at the same time for Northern Ireland not to be part of the customs union or single market.
Okay. And
so they haven't explained how they're going to achieve that aim. Right, they just said what the aim is.
Okay. Now, the real quick question, and I'll move on to Poland here in just a moment, and the Eastern Europe, as you alluded to a few moments ago. Scotland, and I'm curious about the Scots' interest in basically separating from the United Kingdom. What's the future of that in relationship to a possible united Europe?
They've been very quiet on that, actually.
All right.
In recent months, they've gone quiet on the independence issue. They had a referendum a couple of years ago. The Scots voted against independence. All of the opinion polls and everything else indicate that if they did have a referendum at this stage, they wouldn't get the independence vote.
Okay.
And
very
so,
interesting.
They'd have two referendums, and that would probably kill it forever.
Right.
Or for a very, very long time indeed. So I think the Scottish Nationalist Party are biding their time and waiting to see what the repercussions of Brexit are going to be. And if Scotland suffers, then they might push for another referendum.
All right, let's move on to other items here. We've got the Polish government. We've talked about this in the past, and you mentioned it, as a matter of fact, Eastern Europe. And Poland is, well, one foot in Western Europe, one foot in Eastern Europe. And, of course, the Polish government has not really fulfilled all of the requirements of the European Union membership, particularly in the area of the judicial system, a few other items we've talked about in the past. What's the future of the Polish government? You've got a note here that it backs down in a fight from the European
Union. It appeared to back down. It has sacked, the prime minister has sacked six key members of his cabinet.
Okay.
Who were all very Eurosceptic. And that includes the defense, foreign, interior, environment, health, and digital affairs. And this was just before the Jean-Claude Juncker was due to fly to Poland to discuss cutting off subsidies to Poland, EU subsidies, which are $15 billion a year, which Poland desperately needs. They get more money from the EU than any other European country. That's net, by the way. That's it.
Okay.
And so they, you know, they are basically made these moves to try and help the talks with Jean-Claude Juncker.
Okay. And in fact,
we don't know the outcome yet, though.
Okay. And in fact, to keep the money flowing. All right. We've got to move on to the issue related to the mafia here. But very quick question, very quick. What's the future in Spain? How is the Spanish division happening? What is it? Is there a Catalonia?
There's been no real movement since before Christmas. It's a real headache for the Prime Minister Rajoy.
Okay.
He doesn't know which way he's going to go because his party is very much in favor of a federal Spain,
right,
with as few powers to the regions as possible. It's a conservative party. On the other side, the regions, especially Catalonia, want to have more powers and are threatening to break away.
Okay.
He's caught between a rock and a hard place.
All right. We'll leave it at that. I just was curious. We've talked about that in the past. Sort of a wrap up. Let's talk now about a clampdown on the mafia. We've got about 5 minutes to go here. I want to get to that before we move on to a few other items.
We've had 169 people arrested in Italy and Germany. And they also seized $160 million in assets. All right. Now, this sounds like a big, and it's being portrayed as a big move. But you have to remember that the mafia in just 2008, this is just 2008, which is the only one they really have figures for, the only year. It is estimated the mafia in northern Italy mainly had earnings of $167 billion a year. Huge. And that is where now the mafia, its biggest, is in northern Italy. And because it's in northern Italy, it's closer to Germany and Switzerland. And it's starting to move into Germany through the construction industry and the drug trade. And it's getting bigger and bigger in Germany, as well as being huge in Italy.
Is there a concern, and just a quick answer, yes or no, is there a concern that this may have an influence on the European Union's growth?
No, not yet.
All right. That's curious about that. I want to move on to another item, and I'm wondering if this is getting much play. North Korea, of course, is opening communications with both the United States and South Korea. North Koreans at the Winter Olympics. Your observations on this one?
Yes, and it's very interesting. Of course, President Moon has given credit to President Trump, said that he was a big help in reopening the dialogue. But at the same time, the South Korean diplomats are stressing that although President Trump has done a lot, he still should watch his language because it could raise tensions and bring about unintentional clashes, is what I was told.
Okay, well, what's new there?
It's a lot of people, a lot of the commentators or analysts here are saying it's more of a victory for Pyongyang than it is either for Seoul or the United States. Because Pyongyang still has its nuclear weapons, and now it's moving towards a detente. And so he still has a nuclear deterrent, which means he's unlikely to be attacked. And so he can afford to be a bit more open in relations with South Korea.
Okay, that's how it's being spun in one area of the world. The other aspect of this, of course, is that we're thinking that maybe the efforts to dissuade North Korea from some of its actions by its former ally, particularly China, Russia, we understand, is not an ally to anyone, but then an ally to everyone. They don't see this as having any major influence, that you think that this is a matter of North Korea has now decided that they are in a position of superior negotiations, final conclusion, right?
Well, I'm just reporting what some of the diplomatic analysts here are saying.
Okay.
In Europe, yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. All right. A lot of interest in the Winter Olympics starting soon. Is there a lot of interest in the Winter Olympics before we go to this break?
Not a huge interest. I mean, Britain is not a big participant in the Winter Olympics. There probably is in countries like France and Austria and Switzerland,
right,
and Norway.
Okay.
You know, the British thing they do is ice skating.
Right. I just wondered.
That'd be about it. They're saying that they haven't sold many tickets to the Winter Olympics this year.
I know. It's because...
And they're hoping that North Korean participation will boost ticket sales, especially the North Koreans are sending their internationally acclaimed cheerleading squad.
Hmm. All right. Well, we'll be watching that from cover to cover, I'm sure, from opening to close at the Winter Olympics. And I say that tongue firmly planted in cheek. With our guest, Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio, viewpoints around the world.
Look Ahead Radio will return in just a moment.
Observations of an Expat by Tom Arms from LookAheadNews.com. Keep your eye on Moldova. It could be the cause of the next Ukrainian-style flare-up between Russia and the West. A bit of background for those who've never heard of Moldova. It's sandwiched between Romania and southwestern Ukraine. It is the poorest country in Europe. Ranks 103 out of 168 on Transparency International's corruption scale. Is bitterly divided between pro-Russian and pro-Romanian factions. And Russia has troops in a narrow strip of land on the eastern border, which has declared itself independent. Over 80% of the country speaks Romanian. The two countries also share common traditions and even the same name for the respective currencies, the leu. During the interwar years, a big chunk of Moldova was actually part of Romania. After the war, it was part of the Soviet Union. In fact, impoverished, landlocked Moldova has over the centuries bounced back and forth between Romania, Russia, and the Ottoman Empire. The Romanians and Russians have especially left their mark, and peoples, behind. The Russians settled a large community on the banks of the Dniester River, on the eastern border. They are the largest ethnic group in an area generally referred to as Transnistria, although it has also gone by the name of Bessarabia and Podnostrovian Moldovan Republic of Transnistria. When the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, Moldova, all of Moldova, declared itself an independent republic. The Russians in Transnistria were unhappy about this. The result was a civil war with the Russians supporting the Transnistrians. The civil war lasted until March 1992, when a joint commission of Moldova and Russia was set up to monitor a ceasefire. At the same time, the Transnistrians declared themselves independent of Moldova, and some 1,600 Russian troops remained in Transnistria. The only countries which recognized an independent Transnistria were the Ruritanian Russian-created satellites of South Estia, Abkhazia, and the Republic of Artsakh. Russia has withheld formal recognition, but has established a consulate in Transnistria. Then there's Romania, where there's a growing movement to annex all of Moldova. There's a significant minority of Moldovans who favor this. Romania is a member of both NATO and the EU. If there was any move to increase links between Romania and Moldova, then there will be a reaction from Russia. If it is a strong reaction against Romania, then NATO is obligated to come to its defense. In short, it could be a Ukrainian-style situation. The only difference is Ukraine has no significant allies, while Romania has extremely significant and obligated allies. To complicate this utterly complex situation, the Moldovans outside Transnistria cannot decide whether they are pro-Russian or pro-Romanian. The Prime Minister, Pavel Filip, and the courts are pro-Romanian. The President, Igor Dodon, is vehemently pro-Russian. The military is divided. President Dodon's powers are restricted, but he uses them to the fullest to pursue Russian aims. He is in and out of the Kremlin office of Vladimir Putin, and since his election just over a year ago, has been suspended by the Moldovan courts three times for illegal pro-Russian moves. The first two were for refusing to verify the appointments of anti-Russian cabinet ministers, and the most recent was only this past week when he vetoed a parliamentary vote to block Russian news broadcasts. Parliament said the broadcasts were propaganda aimed at undermining the Moldovan government. President Dodon said they should be allowed to protect the principle of free speech. Meanwhile, the security situation in Transnistria is starting to deteriorate. In September, the Russian-backed breakaway government complained of aggressive moves by the Moldovan military. The Russians, who had promised to withdraw their forces, have stayed firmly in place and in 2017 conducted 70 military maneuvers, most of them with the Transnistrian military. The margin for error is rapidly shrinking. The consequences of error are growing.
Welcome back to Look Ahead Radio. Here is Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints around the world with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. Just to remind you, tomorrow's news today, log on to LookAheadNews.com and become a subscriber. Tom, let's talk about two items here before we wrap things up. First, the Chinese Ponzi schemes. What are we talking about here?
We're talking about a lot of people. Not so much money, it is billions and billions of dollars, but a lot of people who are being ripped off. Now, the problem is they deregulated the financial markets in China in 1990. And so you have a lot of people who are very naive about financial dealings, especially in the rural areas. And these people in the rural areas, they don't have a great deal of money. And they see people in the cities becoming richer and richer and richer, and they want to share in it. And so you have these Ponzi scheme operators and pyramid scheme sellers turning up in rural China and saying, you too can be as rich as those middle class people in Shanghai and Beijing and Chongqing.
What is the government doing about this?
Well, they are cracking down. They've recently they're cracking down big time.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got 16 cases, I believe, on waiting for trial at the moment, each one involving billions and billions of dollars. One case recently, two men were sent to prison for life and then some, involving 200,000 people, 200,000 investors who had sold their homes and put all of their money into it. They're completely bankrupt. There was another case in September that involved 900,000 investors.
Wow. I mean, even at the U.S. currency of $2 an investor, that's a lot of money. 900,000. All right.
Well, that's a lot of money, a lot of people who are now virtually wiped out.
Interesting. That's in China, of course, we're talking about. Let's move to one other item here. This is an interesting story. I know something about it. A cardboard prime minister.
Yes, I thought I would draw President Trump's attention to this. I thought he should take a page out of the book of the Thai prime minister, a man called Prayut Chan-o-cha-k.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a press conference the other day, and I think he's going to be using this regularly. He had a press conference the other day. He, by the way, is a former general. Who took power in a military coup in 2014, mm-hmm. calls the press together, gives a short two-minute speech, and they start to ask questions. And so he reaches behind and pulls out a cardboard cutout
mm-hmm.
with an arm which is able to dangle freely so that you can shake it, and says, if you have any questions, ask this man. and then walks off.
How well received was that by the press?
Not very.
Ah, I can't imagine
not
why.
Not very. But yeah, it's something. It's something perhaps President Trump could use. What do you think?
No. We don't need a cardboard cutout. We need the real thing. And I think the rest of the world.
Well, it could be a way of dealing with the fake news and the liberal mainstream press, which he seems to hate so much, despised press.
Well, I'm curious, how is the press received there in the United Kingdom? We'll wrap it up with this question. How is that being received? The press, is it?
You know, it depends on who you're talking to.
Okay.
And which press you're talking about. Generally, the tabloid press, which is newspapers like The Sun and The Daily Mirror and The Daily Mail, who tend to exaggerate things, is not very well received or trusted. Whereas what's called the broadsheet press, such as The Times and The Telegraph, the Financial Times, are usually very well respected.
So the whole issue of fake news is not a topic of discussion there in the UK?
It's an Americanism. It is discussed.
That's interesting. It
started in America. We don't really.
I know.
I suppose it is. It's more a question of privacy intrusion.
I know,
people's privacy being intruded by the press. That is their biggest concern.
Oh, no, I think this is very interesting, and I love your description. It's an Americanism. I also like the idea of the prime minister's, the Thailand's prime minister, using a cardboard cutout. They obviously had some very interesting questions with very interesting reactions and responses, I'm sure, from the media. I look forward to more discussions on this in the future. Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio with us this evening. Tom, a very, well, pleasant evening to you, and thank you for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you, Lockwood.
Viewpoints around the world.
Look Ahead Radio is a production of The Talk Station.